Welcome to The Independent, my show that tries to bring a rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest is my friend and colleague, John Cochran. John is a very prominent economist who specializes in financial economics and macroeconomics. He's the Rosemary and Jack Anderson Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Previously, he was a professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and before that at the University of Chicago Department of Economics. He also writes the very popular Grumpy Economist blog. His most recent book is a very important book called The Fiscal Theory of the Price Level, arguing that inflation is due to government debt and higher interest rates. John and I have a conversation about several of today's key and most controversial issues in economic policy, which are front and center in the Trump era. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, welcome, John Cochran. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So I've, of course, already introduced you as being one of the world's most prominent and knowledgeable economists, so I won't waste your time giving you those accolades. But instead, I want to try to get your explanation of a variety of issues that for people like me who are not economists are sort of difficult to understand. And of course, there's a lot of controversy about a lot of these issues. And so I'm going to sort of go through many different things and we'll see where the conversation goes. The first one I want to talk about is inflation. Why inflation? Because this was one of the key issues of the campaign. This is one of the key issues that people voted on. And it's certainly in the news frequently, particularly since COVID and since a lot of the government spending. And of course, your book has a different take from historically accepted narratives, I think, on the causes of inflation. And without getting too technical, I would like you to first talk about what is inflation, why it's so bad, how it arises, and then what we can do about it.
Okay, well,
that's a big topic.
It is a big topic, but it is one of the most, I study it because it's one of the ones that is hardest to look at from the outside and see quite what's going on. So inflation is really just a decline in the value of money. Your dollars buy less than they used to. So it's the part of all prices and wages, the part of everything that's going up. If you go to Japan, it looks like they measure things in cents. Well, they had a lot of inflation, so all prices and all wages are higher. Why does that hurt? Because along the way, a lot of stuff gets discombobulated. Prices go up more than wages initially. So the average American was very much hurt by the recent inflation. As the prices went up faster than the wages, they couldn't buy as much. And all the hoity-toities telling them that inflation had gone away didn't make much sense to them. They were right because the prices were still higher. So that's what inflation is, and that's why it hurts. It also hurts if you were a saver. If you held government bonds, they're paying you back in money that's about 20% less valuable than it used to be. So that's like a 20% default on government bonds, which is a lot of why they did it. So that hurts too. So there's a lot of discombobulation with inflation. And people don't like it, and they're right not to like it.
Now, let me interrupt and ask questions along the way. One is, There are different ways to sort of calculate or portray the inflation that we as a public experience. We hear a lot about consumer price index. We hear various assessments of inflation, not counting certain things, not counting food or counting food, not counting energy or car gas. I mean, is this all politicization of a calculation or are these legitimate differences? And how should we think of that when we hear that as a public?
These are legitimate differences. And this is what's hard about inflation. So I'll give you econ lesson one. Don't confuse relative prices with inflation. Prices are going up and down all the time. You know, there's avian influenza. So the price of eggs is going up relative to other things, right? Price of eggs has to go up because we can't afford as many eggs. So prices are always going up or down. And what you're trying to measure is that common component of all prices. And that's difficult to do because everything's always going up and down relative to other things. So in the short run, how you measure inflation, do you include the eggs or just the chickens, you know, which came first, makes a lot of difference. There's the old joke of, you know, economists have a sense of humor because they use decimal points, and central bankers must have a real sense of humor because they use two decimal points. How much we've got an exact handle on this thing is difficult. Also, the inflation that you and I feel is different from the inflation that other people feel because we buy different stuff. Inflation is calculated as how much money it takes to buy a standardized bundle of goods around the country. Well, if you're buying gas in California, you're not buying a standardized bundle of goods around the country. So different people feel it differently. And that's part of that, you know, the turmoil of inflation that people don't like. But I would not say that it's badly measured. It's just difficult to measure. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics does as good a job as one could do. But just keep in mind, this is a badly measured concept. So don't get too worried about decimal points. So when it gets to 10%, we know there's inflation. No doubt we had a big inflation.
And why, what do we do about inflation? Okay, what does the government do? What did they do? And what are they doing?
Well, what governments typically do is anything but what will actually fix it, because that's politically difficult. So since the time of Emperor Diocletian's inflation in 300 AD, what they've done is go after hoarders and price gougers and monopolists and greed and so forth, which has nothing to do with inflation because those are about one price relative to another. And that's what our politicians did as usual. Inflation comes fundamentally from exactly what happened in 2021, when the government either borrows money that people don't trust it will pay back, or prints money and hands it out. And we borrowed and printed about $5 trillion during COVID and about $6 trillion immediately afterwards, with no real plans of how to pay it back. People said, well, let's get rid of this stuff pronto. They did, and drove prices up. And if you want to stop inflation, you have to go after the root. Of course, I think you're a doctor, right, Scott? So you would know you don't treat the symptom, you treat the disease, and you have to diagnose it first. It's a very simple diagnosis, but one that is, of course, very inconvenient to people who love to spread money around.
Right, which is the way politicians garner positive public opinion, as they offer to spend money.
Yeah, although in this case, I think it was actually vaguely reasonable, but incredibly overdone. So in every war the United States has had, we have had inflation. Why? The government meets the war by spending like crazy, let's forget about efficiency, borrowing money without a particularly good plan of how to pay it back, printing money, and almost actually deliberately causing the inflation. Because by causing the inflation, you take it out of bondholders. You don't have to raise as much taxes to pay for all that stuff. So our government treated COVID as if it were a war. Unfortunately, they weren't buying tanks. They were just throwing money around in the name of Keynesian stimulus. So it was a, I don't want to say rational, reasonable reaction. It was something we had done many times before. I think the criticism is not so much the doing it, but the vastly overdoing it.
As we go here, you're going to say things that are going to prompt me to ask a question. So excuse it if it's naive, but you know, this idea of Keynesian economics, first, can you define what that means? And then answer my question, which is, it seems to me, as a naive observer, that most people have become Keynesian, most economists, to some extent.
Yes. Sort of the mainstream of the profession, with some iconoclasts at places like the University of Chicago and the Hoover Institution, who still grumble, maybe not, and the University of Minnesota, I'll give them credit too. What it is mostly a bunch of answers in search of a question. But the answer is that the key to economic prosperity is for the government to borrow or print money and hand it out, either to run big government projects, whether those projects do anything or not. I mean, a $100 billion high-speed train from nowhere to nowhere is just as good as Keynesian stimulus, or just give people money. Then people will spend it. We kind of lift ourselves up from our bootstraps, that the problem was sort of lack of demand. So that was the theory.
It's using government to create an economic outcome as opposed to, and maybe I'm wrong, deregulating and letting a free market dominate and generate the outcome.
It is broadly a view that the economic problem is lack of demand, people hoarding their money and not going out and spending it. So we need to give them even more money, as opposed to supply, the productive capacity of the economy. And, like all theories, there's sometimes an element of truth to both. I think after the financial crisis, there was a definite something that sort of smelled of lack of demand. The economy wasn't operating exactly at its full productive capacity. I'll give you another medical example. If a guy's had a heart attack, giving him a cappuccino doesn't necessarily help. The heart attack is the case of lack of supply. You can't go run a marathon. And even if I give you a cappuccino, you're not going to go run a marathon. So that's the question, is in downward times, is it just lack of stimulus? Keynesian stimulus is like, we'll give you a cappuccino. Or is it, you're not in shape? And I think this is where they made a big mistake during COVID. The economy crashed during COVID. Was that because people didn't have enough money to go buy stuff and we just needed to give them money? Or was it because all the restaurants were locked down and there was a raging pandemic and no one wanted to go out? So part of the mistake here was seeing a supply. That was a heart attack. And we needed to unclog the arteries, not just give people cappuccinos.
Right. So let's move from that into the sort of the role of the Fed and then sort of take it into regulating banks and this kind of stuff. Because you've mentioned here the financial crisis. And I think as someone who's interested but not knowledgeable myself, it was always a question, who should we have bailed out? Because we bailed out a lot of things, and the ultimate bailout really has been during the pandemic spending in a funny way. But let's explain, I'd like you to explain to the audience, what is the role of the Fed, or at least what it's supposed to be, and then go from there into the regulation side of things.
Yeah. So the Fed has two roles. One is monetary policy, which is largely setting interest rates, though these days they also have gone into other things like buying lots of government bonds, quantitative easing, with a view towards controlling inflation and not causing recessions or trying to stimulate them with lower interest rates when it comes. The other part of the Fed's job is banking regulation, where they're supposed to make sure that the banks don't all fail, that there are big bank runs. Those are sort of related, but not very related. In fact, lately, we had some hiccups like Silicon Valley Bank, wherein the two sides were not talking to each other and were working exactly to cross purposes.
Right.
So those are the two jobs. Now, financial crisis, what happened is we had a massive bank run. Bank run is when I see you running to the bank to get your money out. And I say, I better run to the bank to get my money out. The bank doesn't have enough money to pay us all. So the bank fails. And then to avoid that kind of failure, everybody runs to the government to get a bailout, which is also what happened in the financial crisis.
Because the banks are not required to hold the money. Obviously, they're lending money so that they can use it. They take some of the money that they take from depositors, for instance, and they use it for other purposes. So they keep a certain amount on hand, but not enough to cover for a bank run, obviously.
Obviously, but not necessarily obviously. So there's a vision that I've been writing about and that actually comes from the University of Chicago in the 1930s. Banks could operate in a way that guarantees no bank runs or bank failures ever, which is they take your deposits and they put them at the Fed where they earn interest on them. That's called a narrow bank. The Fed has been on a war against those narrow banks for reasons that we'll get into later, maybe. Then if they want to make risky loans, they do it the way every other risky company raises money to make risky investments, like say SpaceX, they issue stock. If Tesla or SpaceX loses money, nobody runs to get their money out because you can't run to get your money from stock. If that's the way the banking system worked, then we would never have bank runs again. Unfortunately, since the Great Depression, we've been patching and patching and patching a leakier and leakier boat in which banks get to take deposits, make risky loans with them, and when the loans go bad, they run to the government to get bailed out. And that just gets, it's like the little old lady who swallowed the fly, that gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's where we are.
So we bailed out, we, the government, bailed out the Silicon Valley Bank, correct? they were doing things that really were very high risk with the money, correct? Were they doing what they were only within the confines of the regulations?
It's a very interesting case because they were within the confines of the letter of the regulation, but doing something that any undergraduate with 1 week of economics could spot was a terrible idea. So after all the banks failed in 2008, at least the government had the decency to say, we'll do something about this. We'll stop this from ever happening again. And they passed the hundreds of thousands of pages of Dodd-Frank Act and regulations. The regulators will go make sure the banks don't do dangerous things with your money again. So we go by another 10 years. What did Silicon Valley do? It took uninsured deposits from tech companies around here by paying them high interest rates. And some tech companies had like $500 million in checking accounts, way beyond the insurance.
Wow.
It didn't put those in toxic derivatives or mortgage-backed securities or crazy stuff. No, it bought long-term treasury securities. The problem with long-term treasury securities is if interest rates go up, the value of those treasury securities goes down, and now they don't have enough assets to back the uninsured deposits. Now, these are uninsured deposits, so the Silicon Valley investors, who are apparently all texting each other from in Jackson Hole when this happened, said, wait a minute, this bank is in trouble. And so they all got in their iPhones and took their money out. Boom. And what the government did was, after the fact, guaranteed those deposits to keep them from running. Now, the point of this story is we have hundreds of thousands of pages of regulations. We have an army of regulators looking at every bank, which is really puzzling because banks are about the safest assets ever. Why is it dangerous? Because you leverage 10 or 20 to 1 and anything becomes dangerous. And they couldn't spot this elephant in the room. The most simple interest rate exposure, we've understood this since the 1700s. They couldn't see it. And yet—
The long-term—
Exactly. Borrowing short, lending long. If interest rates go up, you don't have enough assets you can sell to meet your deposits. We've understood this since the Medici started.
Right. I mean, isn't that
why— And they
why,
couldn't see that.
Isn't that why, for instance, an individual puts their cash equivalent investment in a money market because it's all very short term?
And then you know the value. If you can't stand the value of that portfolio to go down, then you invest it short term. Now, if you're investing for the long run, then actually long-term bonds make sense. But
right.
Investing for the long run means when the price goes down, the rate of return goes up. So you'll make it back in the long run, as long as you don't have to meet depositors who are running at your door right now.
Now, what is, for a regular person, this bank deposits are insured up to something like $250,000.
Right.
Is that changing? First of all, is that a good idea to insure these bank accounts, in your opinion? And secondly, is that being looked at again? Or, I mean, what does that mean when the government is insuring that money, really? Because the government has no money, in my view. It's a taxpayer's money.
Yes, it is taxpayer's money. Or printed, so inflated out of taxpayers' pockets one way or another. So lesson two of economics, there's no free money. It always comes from somewhere, track the money around. So we had bank runs in the Great Depression, and what our government chose to do was to guarantee the deposits. And that works to stop the bank run. If you know that you can always get your money back from the government and you see me running to the bank to get my money, you know, I don't have to run. So that works. But if banks can now raise money from insured deposits, you and I have no incentive to look and see, well, what's the bank doing with that money? Do I care if they're going to Las Vegas or buying crypto or investing in mortgages? Or, you know, I don't care about their risk management anymore. Aha! Regulators will come in and make sure that the banks don't do risky loans. And then the banks find creative ways to get around the regulations, and then they fail, and then we guarantee more deposits, and then they add more regulations. And this is the endless patching of the leaky boat. The system of, if you take deposits, you got to put them in short-term treasuries or reserves. If you want to make risky loans, you got to issue equity. That's the system we chose not to do in the 1930s, and that's the fundamental source of the problem. Are we going back? Doesn't look like it, because the banks love this system. They get to leverage up like crazy, and if anything goes bad, the government bails them out. Why would banks not love this system? They do, and they're very politically powerful.
And they know that they're going to be. I mean, the reality is we always seem to bail out the banks. I mean, is that an incorrect view? Or
Let's be careful. What we actually bail out are the depositors, the bank's creditors. Now, those are often other banks. So, you know, when we bailed out AIG in the financial crisis, who we were really bailing out was Goldman Sachs, because AIG owed Goldman Sachs a whole lot of money. And Goldman said, oh, boy, if we don't get our money back, we're in trouble, too. The banks often, you know, the stock in the banks goes to nothing, typically. And the bank management may lose their jobs, but we bail out the people who lent money to the banks, thereby giving them no incentive to be careful about where they lend their money.
Right. I mean, that. But we also bail out industries. For instance, the airlines, even publicly traded industries, it seems like the government is commonly bailing out industries rather than letting them fail and having the entire system of bankruptcy. This is sort of a different topic, but it has to do with this. I still don't understand why that happens.
Well, yes, the idea of what's systemically important got really diluted. I would advise your listeners, when you hear gobbledygook from especially central bankers, it's gobbledygook. It isn't technical language that you don't understand. So then, yeah, airlines became systemically important. GM and Ford got bailed out. Now, why do they need a bailout? Well, airlines were borrowing a lot of money too. Airlines don't own their airplanes. They borrow money for their airplanes. And of course, if the airplanes have to sit on the ground for a couple months, the airlines are going to go under. So too much leverage is what caused the airlines to be fragile. And therefore, the government faced a hard choice, bail them out or, you know, bankrupting all the airlines means after the pandemic, you're in trouble. And that's when a crisis hits, you got to bail out. You'll bail out. I'll bail out. In the crisis is a terrible time to grow a spine. The problem is after the crisis, you got to clear out the fragility of the system, stop everybody from borrowing money and counting on the bailout next time. And of course, political will for doing that is often missing. You know, to their credit, the Dodd-Frank people at least tried to do something about it. They did the wrong thing about it, but they at least tried. This time, we went through it all again in 2020, 2021. The bailouts to the airlines, bailouts to the treasury, bailouts to the municipal bond market, bailouts to the corporate bond market. We just bailed out every, and there's not just even the slightest, boy, that was a problem. We need to put that moral hazard back in a bottle, do something about it. No, just pat ourselves on the back, river of money. We kept it all going.
Mm-hmm. So we don't, because we have a mechanism for companies to declare bankruptcy. It doesn't mean they disappear. But we don't seem to allow that mechanism to happen frequently, except on the small business level, of course.
The small or not very politically connected business.
Right.
This is important to understand. Bankruptcy does not mean there's a crater where there used to be a business. Bankruptcy means reorganization. Bankruptcy means that the court system does its best to keep the company going as an effective operation. What happens in bankruptcy is the stockholders lose all their money. The bondholders don't get paid back in full. They get paid back, you know, some amount on it. And we try to keep the company going under new management. So important people lose money. Now, the new management will often try to streamline operations. Why is this company losing money? So people will lose their jobs. We'll sell off, you know, profitable parts to someone else. We'll reorganize the company to try making go. Bankruptcy is a fine and noble institution. It is difficult and time-consuming. So there is that we didn't want a wave of bankruptcies all at the same time. So there is a reason to try to have, to try to limit it, which means don't let companies, especially financial companies, borrow a huge amount of money and then go bankrupt. You got to start with the don't borrow so much money in the first place.
Right. Let's talk about interest rates and the Fed setting interest rates. And, you know, you and I work at Hoover and we you know, you're an economist, of course. So, you know, John Taylor rule and all this more intent on trying to set more criterion based interest rates rather than subjective setting of interest rates. Well, let me hear your explanation and opinion on that.
So the explanation, let me give you the sort of the traditional view. So the traditional view is that by raising interest rates, the Fed softens the economy, and then somehow softening the economy will also bring down inflation.
I mean, dampening out the rapid growth and all this kind of stuff.
Right, or even causing a recession. You really want, you know, soften could go that far too. The difficulty there is that in the standard view, it takes some time for these to have an effect. So in Milton Friedman's famous example, it's like, you know, you're turning on the hot and cold water on the shower, and you don't want to turn it hot and then turn it cold and turn it hot again. You want to do this, you know, systematically and slowly. So Friedman was an advocate of a rules-based policy, you know, and the reason was he looked in history and saw the Fed doing exactly the shower thing, overreacting, underreacting, getting too much caught up in the day's news. And that kind of fits in philosophically. We like a government of rules, of institutions, of rule of law, of steadiness, not of, you know, this week we're doing this, next week we're doing that. Not a lot of guessing about what's the Fed going to do. You know,
well, it's not just that we like it. It's just the uncertainty, at least some of my friends in economics have said, you know, one of the issues, and we'll talk about this a little bit with the, some of the Trump policies, is the uncertainty on businesses, the uncertainty and unpredictability. Rules are seemingly a calming sort of steadying influence on what business and what governments can anticipate. It's simply the uncertainty alone is a problem, correct?
Yes, and I think that's quite right. It's not healthy to have an economy where everybody is tuned into Bloomberg all the time to know, is the Fed going to up, down, sideways? We're kind of in that and, you know, reading the tea leaves of what are the adjectives in the latest speech. Oh, he said measured, quick, sell your stuff. That's not healthy.
But that's exactly what happens, correct? I mean,
That's where we are. Now, there is an argument for discretion, and I'll pass it on, which is that each thing that the Fed faces is not the repetition of something familiar, but something quite unprecedented. So in the financial crisis, that was very different from any recession the Fed had faced. COVID was very different from anything that the Fed had faced. And you have to be able to, you don't want to be chained to a rule. You have to be lyric. Now, I think our colleague John Taylor has a very sensible squaring of the circle. The rule is a benchmark. You would say, you know, in normal circumstances, as inflation gets going, it's time for us to raise interest rates. So we will have to both think and communicate our action by reference to that rule. If we're deviating from that, we'd better have a reason.
Right.
And I think, you know, the one of the most astounding things, inflation came out in February 2021. That's when it started with the huge spending of the incoming Biden administration. Inflation kept going. Now, back in the 1970s, last time we had inflation, the Fed quite quickly raised interest rates once inflation came out. Maybe not fast enough, but quite quickly. This time, the Fed waited a whole year. They sat at 0% interest rates while inflation surged up to 8% and did not move anything for a whole year.
Why?
Wow. Well, that's a big question. You can ask them or you can look at the data and see. But that's to your question of rules. I think, you know, John Taylor's way of phrasing it, if they said, look, the rule says raising interest rates now because inflation is surging, why are we not doing that? That might have helped them to get ahead of the curve.
Right. But it seems my recollection is that there were people in the Biden administration who kept insisting that this is just a blip, that or at least my perception of what they were saying, this is temporary, inflation is temporary. I think Janet Yellen and others were saying this. And of course, all things are temporary in the long term. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. It clearly had a massive effect, detrimental effect, the inflation. It wasn't very temporary, but it did start to come down.
Now, I think there's two understandings of what they did. One is not right. The other is right and more dangerous for the future. Why did they sit on their hands? It does happen that, you know, like there's an oil price shock, you know, say, or a frost in Florida and the price of oranges goes up and then the price of oranges will come back again. So you measure a little inflation and the price of oranges goes up and then you'll get deflation when it comes back again. And the Fed should just ignore that sort of thing. So their first reaction was they saw the disruptions of the pandemic and said, oh, this is a supply shock, a price that will come up and then a price that will come back again, a temporary price movement. Well, it soon became clear that wasn't what was happening because everything was going up. So I think making that mistake of a price that's going to come up and come back again was the first one. But that doesn't excuse the whole year. I think the more serious one is this was a supply shock. You know, what was happening in the pandemic, it was like a heart attack. the economy's capacity for producing things wasn't as high as much, so prices were going up.
Well, it was shut down.
It was shut down.
Yeah.
Well, this was in 2021 when it was clear the pandemic was over and the heart attack was unclogging quickly. So why did they keep pouring cappuccinos in as the heart attack is unclogging? When a central bank faces a supply shock, a reduced capacity of the economy to produce, a stagflationary shock, they have a choice. One is, look, it's going to be bad. This output won't be as high because our economy can't produce as much. The other is they meet it with more money, with low interest rates, and we get more inflation and less output reduction. And that's what they did in the 1970s. They saw the oil price shocks, and they said, well, if we just let that happen, we'll get big recessions, so we'll choose more inflation and a little less recession. And I think that's what they did. They saw these supply shocks, and they just said, we would rather see inflation than any price goes. So what could happen is, so Pelotons are going to go up, right? Because everyone wants one, you can't get them to the ports. Well, either the price of Pelotons goes up or wages go down. Either way, you know, we ration the Pelotons. The Fed says, let's let this happen. Actually, let's let this happen. Because if we think if wages go down, that might cause a recession. So they choose inflation when there's a supply shock. Now, the reason I'm emphasizing this is we're about to hit another supply shock, tariffs.
Right.
The tariffs are a negative supply shock. By themselves, they mean the price of imported goods goes up. Now, does that mean the price of imported goods goes up or wages go down? In any case, total output's going to go down. It's a stagflationary shock.
But those tariffs cause, strictly speaking, inflation. Would you say the answer is yes or not really?
Not really. They cause a price to go up, which if the Fed gives us the money to pay the higher prices, then we'll get inflation. If the Fed says, no, we're not giving you the money, then that price goes up. Then that price goes up and other prices go down. There's no overall change, but that price as it goes up and other prices goes down. The Fed decides, this is going to happen. Imported prices go up, other prices, relative to other prices. But does this happen? Does this happen? Does this happen? That's the Fed's choice.
Well, there's another sort of potential outcome, at least in my way of thinking, and that is because now we're talking about tariffs and the impact of tariffs. Okay, so let's just say that there's a tariff on an imported good. Let's say that there's wine imported from France. The U.S. is the biggest market. I mean, I happen to like wine. And so I'm sensitive myself to the price of wine. There's another sort of secondary outcome from the tariffs, not just that the price stays the same. France may decide, you know what, we need to have the... If the prices are passed on to the American consumer for these things, they'll decrease the amount they buy. And isn't it true, or isn't it possible and probable that France will have to say, you know what, we still need to sell our wine. Americans are the biggest consumers of wine. We're willing to take a little bit less profit. We need to reduce the price. It's almost like a supply and demand thing, isn't it?
Yes. Let me just... thought I was going for years. By not being honest about how we reacted to the last supply shock, we're going into the next supply shock unprepared. And the Fed is going to face a tough choice. It's a stagflationary shock. Are they going to let it inflate more or are they going to let it cause a recession? And they haven't really been honest about last time, so they're not really prepared for next time. Now, let's get into tariffs. Yes, maybe it's a good thing for the U.S. You have isolated the one vaguely plausible argument for tariffs. As an economist, stamped on your union card is tariffs bad.
Right.
Or at least, let's be clear, because everything is an answer to a question. Tariffs bad if the point is make the economy as a whole better off. And the easiest way to see that is if tariffs were great between the U.S. and France, they would be great between California and Nevada, and they'd be great between Palo Alto and San Francisco. And we all kind of understand how that's a terrible idea. So from an economic point of view, why would we do it to France? The one potential argument is that, yeah, we can force France into giving us better terms because we're such a big customer. Now, that is a standard argument for tariffs, but let's think about it. First of all, what it means when you look through the money is that we want France to send us more wine than we send them stuff. Viewed on a quantity basis, what we're asking is for more imports. When France sends us wine, we send them stuff, right? So what we're asking when we raise the tariff and try to get a better price on the wine, basically, is that you will actually send us more stuff. So it's a little inconsistent to say, I want tariffs because I don't like imports. The other part is, there's this fallacy of a big pool of profit out there. This is the general left-wing fallacy, that there's a big pool of profit out there that we can make absorb. We'll just make the pharmaceutical companies lower prices for the American, and they'll come out of this pool of profit somewhere. Like there's this Scrooge McDuck swimming pool that we can just tax. Similarly, that these evil French are making so much money on the wine, we'll just force them to send it to us for less. It's not the way the world works.
Right. I think there's price caps that I think is the argument that these people are using in terms of drug prices, which is a separate topic sort of, but Econ 1, not even Econ 101, says that if you cap prices, you're going to limit the supply of the good. But in terms of the tariff argument, I think it's more complicated because, I mean, there's a tariff argument for the idea of potentially of bringing businesses and production back into America. This is the so-called America First economic agenda. There's an idea of, hey, wait a second, country X puts a tariff on our stuff. Why is that fair? We want to open market. So we want to say the so-called, quote, reciprocal tariff, unquote, that is obviously simplistic because parts of goods and other things are made in multiple countries, et cetera. But this idea that if they tariff us, why wouldn't we tariff them? And if they'll drop their tariff, then we'll drop our tariff. That's another issue. And then the third issue is sort of a negotiating ploy of, say, we feel like there's a lot of asymmetries in the way the American government and therefore taxpayer pays for things in other countries. For instance, the national defense issues and all this. And I think if you take it all into, I think there is a view that President Trump uses tariffs as a larger negotiating tool for a bunch of things. So that's a lot. Again, like there's three different issues there for you to pontificate about them. I'm letting you have your choice.
I counted them. You gave me five. So the problem with tariffs is that, like any tax, tariffs are a bad thing. And that's kind of obvious. And then the discussion is, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? So our job is swatting down fallacies one by one.
Sure.
You got it closest with the America can negotiate a better deal. And the last thing I was going to say on that is, even if we could, is that our place in the world? Is America's place in the world to try to enrich Americans by making French people, Canadians, and Mexicans poorer, or Africans? I mean, why do we simultaneously give foreign aid and then try to make them poorer at our expense? That makes no sense whatsoever. And why do we try to take by legal means what we won't send the U.S. Marines to take? If you want to make Americans richer by making Mexicans poorer, well, just send the Marines to go grab stuff. We don't want to do that, so why are we trying to do the same thing with tariffs? Protection. The idea that American businesses will prosper under protection. Well, we've tried that over and over again. Every protected industry sinks into inefficiency and learns how to get more protection. Look at the wonders of our steel and our shipbuilding industry, which have been under walls of protection for decades. They're disasters. They can't even come within three to five times the cost of foreigners. They don't even use modern technology. Protection just breeds more protection and inefficiency. Look at Latin America. That's a Latin American economy.
Can I ask a question?
Please, because I'm going to go out to 3, 4, 4, and 5.
Right.
If you don't.
I want you to do that. But that point, what you're saying, I think, or maybe I'm just thinking of myself, is that another form of tariff, or sort of related, is how your government, our government, will simply artificially prop up an industry, a domestic industry. That's sort of it's the same thing. We prop up, we pay farmers to not only grow things, we pay them to not grow things. I mean, we're propping up an industry artificially, internally on our own. Is that correct?
Yes. As we are propping up electric vehicles and batteries, so long as they use American parts and union labor and, you know, free childcare and so forth.
Right.
Which is part of why it always lends to inefficiency. There's tariffs and subsidies kind of go in hand as methods of protecting politically popular industries from competition.
And these are, of course, counter to what people would consider free markets.
Yes, and they're also counter to the economic interest of the United States, because doing stuff inefficiently at home that you can buy from abroad is not good. And if it breeds ever more inefficiency, that's not good. And of course, steel is a great example, because more expensive domestic steel is an input to everybody else. And so everybody who's looked at this says, oh, tariffs on steel actually cost us jobs, because so many jobs depend on using steel as opposed to jobs producing steel. This is like 1930s WPA pictures of smokestack stuff to believe that we should be subsidizing steel.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned defense. There is a narrow national defense interest, of course. During a war, you want to have a steel plant. You don't need that much, though. You don't need to make bicycles in the U.S. during a war. You need to have enough steel, very high-grade, very specialized steel to make airplanes. And my answer to that would be, rather than subsidize chips and bicycles and whatever else, put it on the defense budget. Tell the generals, hey, $100 billion, that's 10 aircraft carriers or one chip plant? What do you want? Let us know. That would be, I think, a much better way to get the targeted amount that actually is a genuine national security interest, as opposed to what happens, which is we throw protections at everything, wrapping it up in the flags. Reciprocity would be nice. I would love to see. Now, we are not hurt by other countries' tariffs. So the right answer is always unilateral free trade from an economic point of view. But it's better for the world as a whole if other countries do it. And politically, it's easier to say, well, we're going to get rid of our tariffs and they're going to get rid of theirs. So, okay, everybody's got the connected, protected businesses have to take a hit here. I don't see that in the current tariffs. So we are not saying, Trump said reciprocity, but he did not and legally can't reduce tariffs. We have not reduced our tariffs to places where other countries are charging less than we are.
Are there examples yes. where we are charging tariffs that are asymmetrically higher than what other countries
yes.
are?
But I don't have the list of tariffs right
okay.
now.
Okay, no, that's fine. That's fine. I'm just asking.
And we are not. There's plenty of places where we're charging more, and we are not saying. If they were saying loudly, the day after you lower a tariff on the U.S., we will lower it on you. If we were saying loudly, the goal of this is complete free trade everywhere. That's what we're trying to get to. I'd be happy. I'm not hearing any of that, especially out of the president's advisors who seem to like tariffs. And then there's we need to protect America. And then there's national defense. And
right.
There's not allowed. What we want to do is get GATT and the World Trade Organization and worldwide free trade going. We're not hearing that.
We're not hearing that the argument for tariffs is to eliminate all tariffs.
No, I am not hearing that at all.
Yes. What about this question, if I can ask? There's a claim by some people in the administration that somehow there's this windfall of revenue coming from tariffs. That seems to be a little bit short-sighted and I think it's incorrect, because there's a reaction to the tariffs. It doesn't make sense to me. Am I correct, or what do you think?
Yeah, you're correct. So first of all, it is true the United States, the federal government was largely supported by tariffs in the late 1800s. The federal government was also about 1% of GDP back then, and now government overall is about 40% of GDP. So there's just not enough imports to do it. And tariffs are a particularly inefficient way of raising money for the government, because, in fact, the reactions are so swift that you do a lot of economic damage per dollar raised. And that's why we don't have tariffs on California versus Nevada. One of the greatest things our founders did was, under the Commerce Clause, says there will not be tariffs in between the states. Canada has tariffs between its provinces. One of the reasons they're a lot poorer than we are. So if that argument made sense, it would make sense for tariffs between the states to raise revenue. Well, we know we don't want to do that, so I think that, and it's just quantitatively, it's not big enough. The last thing I wanted to bring up is this foreign policy part, that this is part of a four-dimensional chess to negotiate, which is, that's a non-economic argument. So, as economists, we have to listen hard to that one. Aircraft carriers cost money, but they come in useful when you're negotiating. So to say tariffs hurt the economy, the foreign policy people could say, yeah, they do, but they come in useful when we're negotiating. We have to listen and get some credence to that. But I don't see that happening right now either, although here we're stepping outside a little bit of our expertise. We're trying to, if we're having some geostrategic thing against China, we want friends on our side. We want a global trading block on our side and then, freeze out China. I think that's what we want to do. I don't think that's a good idea either, but, let's say that that's what they want to do.
Uh-huh.
Why would you tariff Canada and Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
And why would you do it in a way that pisses them off? That the administration looks very likely that it will do the nearly impossible, which is to get the Liberals reelected in Canada, and create a trading bloc between Canada and Europe that shuts out the U.S. And when we're asking Canada and Mexico, hey, we would like it if you guys didn't trade with China, they're going to say, well, screw you, because we can't trade with you, so we're going into China. And we might get Europe to start trading with China as well. So it's just very hard to me to see that this is a smart foreign policy move either.
Yeah. Your view then is that one of the negative consequences is making our adversaries more desirable trading partners. Now, and I think this is a big problem. Again, in my view, I have some knowledge about Latin America and trade, and I've seen over the years how we had an opportunity with Trump version one Bolsonaro, to have a country that refused to sort of Brazil, that is the biggest, potentially the biggest and most important country in the Western Hemisphere, really outside of the United States in some ways. They wanted to ally with the US, and now we have something quite opposite. The Biden administration stiff-armed the Brazil Bolsonaro government, and Lula, who's now president, is a communist, a stated communist, really, who is an ally of China. I think that's not only is it an economic lost opportunity for us, but it's a national security issue. So I think this has a lot of ramifications. I mean, this is where trade is really an issue. Trade and the economics of everything has national security ramifications. I mean, that's undeniable, even for people like me who I'm not a national security person.
But, China's BYD can make a great electric car for $15,000, and it makes cheap bicycles and construction equipment, and it knows how to make ports and knows how to make ships. We want Latin America to say, no, be on our side. Don't do that with China. Well, give them something for being on our side. But I want to say we've gone on a little bit about the dangers of tariffs, which is, tariffs are economically costly. They are, however, a limited economic cost. It's a 25% tax on imports. Well, the corporate profits tax is 21% already. Sales tax is 9%. We got plenty of taxes that raise prices. It's not quotas. It's not, bilateral deals where you can at least buy the thing from Canada. It's just going to cost you more. And this is the one big unforced error, which is why I'm sad about it. But the Trump administration has done a lot of wonderful things economically, which I think will help the economy. So overall, the idea that the economy is terrible, I think we are right to focus on this as their big error. But overall, they're doing a lot of stuff that's great. And the tragedy is, of course, that this, you get remembered for your biggest mistakes. So if they persist,
especially
in this mistake,
politically,
it'll wash out. And if it causes a recession, especially, it'll wash out all the tremendous stuff they're doing in so many other areas.
Right, including just focusing on a growth-related economy and a business environment that is beneficial to the country economically.
Exactly.
What about this idea that the tariffs could be used as a way to eliminate some other taxes? Is that just a hypothetical that in your view will never happen, or is that something that is a realistic possibility? Because that's been voiced.
Oh, well, it's back to the revenue question. Just, in terms of the giant sucking sound of the federal government rat hole, tariffs are not that much of a revenue raiser. So, whether you use it to reduce taxes or to pay down debt, there's just not that much money there.
Okay.
Sorry to say.
Yeah. So in a funny way, that it seems like the sort of brouhaha over tariffs is a bit exaggerated, because it's not as economically impactful as a harm, really, at least economically, purely economically, as people seem to say. Is that a reasonable statement?
Well, it's an open question. Empirically, times like the Smoot-Hawley tariff of the 1930s were a disaster. Empirically, countries that have been open to trade have really prospered. You look over history, you know, the Netherlands, Venice, Hong Kong, Singapore, all were in their golden ages, tremendously prosperous, and they're tiny because they trade. In part because openness to trade makes you open to competition and open to innovation. So that's beyond just, you know, I said it's only a 25% tax, what a big deal. But once you cut yourself off and protect yourself, then you are no longer forced to learn how to innovate, do new things, cut costs. Cutting costs is really hard. Right.
And out-competing.
I think tariffs are more economically damaging in the long run than just the 25% tax suggests. But I would say that the basic problem is that, like so much, they're an answer in search of a question. And you can see that politically. Both parties, you know, Trump said this, but the Democrats do it as well. Tariff. What's the question the tariff is answering? It was fun because you gave me a list of seven questions. Well, if we would just agree on one of these questions, then we can figure out what a good policy response is to that question and whether tariffs do it. But the minute, you know, someone says, well, this is good because it's going to make American business stronger, you swat that one down. Oh, no, but it's good because it's going to help national security. Then you swat that one down. Oh, well, we have to protect our infant industries. Come on, give me the question and we'll find the answer.
Now, generally, as you alluded to, the Trump administration under Trump 1, and I anticipate Trump 2, will be deregulation, generally. Not so much tariffs, really. That's a lot of the news cycle. But the real emphasis is deregulation in a general sense. And I want to talk about deregulation with regard to something that is sort of a peripheral hot issue these days, and that's crypto. Because the Trump administration is certainly making crypto more visible. This is a sort of at least in my view, very poorly understood issue by the American public. Crypto, the standard currency, is crypto really a currency or is it just an asset like a stock that is a speculative asset, in fact? And sort of how we should think of as individuals about this whole topic of crypto. And I'm not. I want to interrupt and say I'm not asking for investment advice here, and I don't think you want to give it. But I do want to talk about what is the role of crypto today, and do you see it becoming an alternative to a system where the dollar is the world's sort of standard, or I mean, where are we going with this?
So listen. So crypto is a technology that's new that implements financial ideas that are centuries old. And there's two versions of the financial idea. One of the financial idea is unbacked paper money. So Scott Atlas prints Scott Atlas dollars and convinces John to give Scott a real dollar for a Scott Atlas dollar. And that's great, eh?
John's that stupid, though. That's the problem.
Well, somehow people are for crypto. So we've so Bitcoin is the original one. It's unbacked fiat money, and that can be useful if people have a reason to transact in Bitcoin rather than U.S. dollars. So far, the main reason has been to avoid taxes and to avoid various unpleasant laws, like, you know, ransomware and pirates and so forth. But also a great way to get money out of China or into Venezuela or, you know, even into Ukraine. We don't necessarily want every law to be enforced, in particular China's currency laws. So there's good and bad there on avoiding laws. So it's primarily a means of illegal transactions. A better use of crypto is the stable coins. So these implement via technology the money market fund, which is a great invention. Scott has a supply of U.S. treasuries. He issues pieces of paper that say, hey, you own some of these treasuries via me, and that piece of paper can circulate as money. And stable coins implement that and can be a very good way of making transactions. It's not very efficient for domestic transactions. The way we have electronic money, it's reserved to the Fed. It works pretty well. But it could be, I think there's a future there for crypto in international transactions, which is fairly inefficient. And then it's a lot of ways for a lot of people to take other people for a big ride in a giant casino. And I think that's a lot of the attraction right now.
But you don't. But what about the people who say, well, no, this is a way to get the government away from, quote, controlling our money? You know, your money, my money, most people's money is in the U.S. banking system in some way or another. And what about people who just don't like that? They're very libertarianish, and they want to have a system of money that the government just doesn't control. Because the way I see it, legitimization of crypto is occurring the more regulation that occurs. And so it sort of obviates that whole concept.
It's an interesting possibility. And now, crypto is not very useful for regular transactions. Ecuador, for example, put it in and eventually just gave up on it. The problem, of course, is what is it backed by? And it's just money that's backed by nothing. So that will work as long as people agree to only use Bitcoin. The Achilles heel there is, well, you can trade up other coins. Right. And so there's nothing, if you want to have a fiat currency that's not backed by anything, you must limit the supply of that stuff. Bitcoin is limited in supply, but there's nothing that limits you from forking it and creating something else. And that's why I think eventually that libertarian, unfortunately. Now, if it were backed by something real, a private money backed by real assets, I think could have somewhere to go if it were computationally efficient.
You mean like gold? Is that an example?
Well,
or is that
gold itself is kind of like, who cares about
right.
gold?
Well, gold is the same. I never understand this, which is that the only reason gold is of value is people have decided, yeah, that's valuable. It's just like a diamond. You know, you think a diamond's valuable. Why? I mean, you know, and so tell me about that. And if we can, because why do we not use gold as a standard? Or what about the people who say we should go back to a gold standard? What is that argument?
Yeah, gold, it's a lovely vision, and I like the philosophy of it, but it doesn't work for the U.S. The problem is, suppose we tied the dollar to gold and said you can have a gold bar for every dollar bill. Why does that stabilize what we really want, which is the price of goods and services in terms of dollars? Whereas, you know, the gold price fluctuates like crazy. Well, maybe the dollar would be stable in terms of gold, but then everything else would inflate and deflate relative to gold. And that's what happened under the gold standard. It wasn't very good at controlling bursts of inflation and deflation.
So there was no, so that, but yet still there are some people, I don't know if they're legitimate or not, who say that we should go back to a gold standard. That you said that makes no sense, you're saying.
It makes some sense, but I don't think it's a good idea. Because the gold standard, the problem with the gold standard is it kept the dollar in terms of gold steady, but there was waves in inflation and deflation. The biggest one was the 1930s. The 1930s, the value of the dollar went down by doubled. Value of the dollar doubled. Prices went down by half. So the stock market went down by 95%. And the price of goods and services went down by half. A huge deflation, which was part of the Great Depression. And the gold standard is unable to stop that. So that kind of volatility is that's the problem of the gold standard. I think that the best libertarian vision is a private money that's backed by something real, like stocks, bonds, you know, goods and services, and so forth, and somehow maintains a stable value. The question is, this is the way money has been. Gold is essentially unbacked money, volatile. Then we created paper money. So the original first paper money, banks issued money backed by mortgages. Now, mortgages are pretty decent backing for money. You know, there's something of value that backs the value of the notes that they issue.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there were bank runs and real estate crises and so forth. Our current money, back to our first question on fiscal theory and prices, our current money is fundamentally backed by the ability of the U.S. government to tax in order to maintain its value. In the end, if there's too much inflation, the government can soak up the extra money by charging taxes. So our money is backed by taxes in the way that 19th century money was backed by real estate. Now, as long as the U.S. maintains a fairly healthy fiscal policy, backing by taxes is a wonderful source of real value for money. So where does the libertarian vision come in? When the U.S. so completely screws up our fiscal policy that we're unable to back our money with taxes, and
it has a massive debt out of control.
Exactly, a debt out of control, spending out of control, essentially defaults on its currency, and we hyperinflate the dollar. That's when, and somehow the computers still work. that's when this sort of libertarian vision. I hope that doesn't happen, because that would be such an awful thing. And the second libertarian vision, which worries me a lot, is anonymity. Right? When money started, nobody knew what you were buying. Now, the U.S. government can track everything you buy and sell, and that's getting worse. And, you know, like the Canadian truckers who got kicked out of the banking system.
Right, the whole debanking scandal.
So the more and more the government takes over or watches the financial system or the electronic money, the less and less your political freedom is in danger. You know, next time some Scott Atlas steps out of line and says something about COVID that that party doesn't like, Scott Atlas will find that his credit card doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the second libertarian vision for wanting to have something. Now, that's difficult because if you have total anonymity of transactions, nobody ever pays taxes again. So we need some compromise here, but I think that's a second force to think about for why people are enthusiastic about crypto.
But yet, isn't it true that the more Bitcoin or crypto in general becomes standardized or used or and therefore regulated, the less anonymous it becomes? I mean, or am I just thinking wrong on that?
Well, that's a lot of the regulation is to bring crypto within the regulated system. First of all, to make people pay taxes on capital gains and losses with crypto, if we choose to charge those, which is kind of a silly idea anyway. But then to enforce know your customer rules and enforce we don't want certain people accessing the banking system and so on and so forth. So to try to bring them into the regulated system for good, you know, we want people to pay taxes. If Bitcoin is completely anonymous out there, no one's going to pay taxes again. You'll just, you know, we'll both tell our boss, hey, pay us in crypto and don't file W-2s.
Right.
So that's, I know that's the danger of anonymity, but the plus of anonymity is your right to dissent is much stronger if you can't be shut out of the financial system, which has happened.
Absolutely.
Pot dealers, for private universities, Republican politicians have been, Canadian truckers have been debanked for their political opinions. This is not as far away or libertarian fear-mongering as you think.
Right. I want to finish with one sort of topic that is sort of amazing to me, and that is the Milei in Argentina and how they had a country out of control with inflation and spending and all kinds of ineffective government. And then within a year, at least according to my reading, within months, actually, inflation dramatically decreased. And could you explain how that happened, or did that even happen? And what are we to think about somebody who comes in and just makes these very draconian, what many people would think were common sense cuts? Why is that so unique? And did it work? And is it working?
I think so. We'll see how long it works. Chile had a bunch of very nice free market reforms, but then they backed off of those too. So, you know, politically is the big question. It is a fascinating phenomenon. If we had taken bets on, will a libertarian whose dogs are named after, Hayek and von Mises, be president of Argentina? And if so, will he last more than 2 days? Had we taken that bet about 5 years ago, nobody would... we'll take the other side of that, which I think is comforting. You know, people keep saying to people like me, oh, it's not politically possible. It's not politically feasible. You know, what you're asking for will never happen. I say, oh, well, could a libertarian be elected president of Argentina?
Right.
Once you piss people off enough, what's politically feasible turns around in a hurry. So on his inflation question, this is just classics of fiscal theory of the price level. It's a phenomenon we've seen over and over many times. Inflation gets out of control. Why? The government's printing up money to cover its debts, to cover its bills. It's spending more than it takes in, can't borrow anymore, prints money, dot, inflation. What stops that? What stops that is when the government cures the budget deficit problem, and in particular, cures it durably. So people have faith that it's not going to come back in a minute or two. Here, Milei's is so far it's B plus. He's done an amazing job of curing it. How long it'll last is harder. But when the minute it's clear that we're not going to be printing up money to finance the budget, once you clear the budget problem, then the inflation goes away. Without the central bank never raised interest rates above inflation. They never had to run tight money supply. And this has happened many times. The most famous is the end of the hyperinflations after World War I. Germany was hyperinflating, 10 to the 13th kind of inflation. the day they solved their fiscal problem by renegotiating the Treaty of Versailles, the inflation stopped. No high interest rates. Actually, they printed more money afterwards because people trusted the money again. They were able to borrow again because people trusted the government again. So solving the fiscal problem is the way to solve an inflation. And every serious inflation has always been solved by solving the fiscal problem. So it's a great, for me, it's another, you know, case study 101 in how fiscal policy underlying is the central force of inflation.
So last question on this. So just to clarify, can economic growth cure inflation?
Yes. I'm glad you brought this up, because economic growth is the little Pandora that comes out of the box last, but is the only and most important economic question overall. I mean, not just can it cure inflation, but it can cure everything else. You know, if we want to pay off our debt or pay Social Security, you know, your choices are either cut benefits and throw grandma off the back of the train, raise taxes so high that we stagnate, you know, into Venezuelan levels of poverty, or, economic growth. Because economic growth means you don't have to spend so much. It means tax revenue comes flowing in even with lower tax rates. Economic growth is always the answer, no matter what the question is. So in this case, in my analysis, we're based on fiscal policy. Economic growth is the easiest way for the U.S. to sustainably pay back its debts and have the fiscal space to not run into another inflation like we just had, to meet any challenge that we have. And so it helps the government finances, and the government finances are ultimately what controls inflation. But economic growth is, of course, that's only 5% of the reason why economic growth is great. Economic growth should be the number one, the only thing that we pay attention to, because over decades, it's the only thing that matters. And who gets what and everything else that they worry about is nothing compared to economic growth. Just think about how your grandparents and great-grandparents lived relative to how we live. Do we want that to happen again, or do we want to be exactly where we are now fighting over stuff? That's what economic growth is about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, John, I'm going to end it there, but I could talk to you about 100 things in and outside economics. I appreciate your wisdom and knowledge. This economic discussion is quite complicated for those of us who really we hear different things, and it's very difficult to follow. So I think you clarified a lot of things. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. This has been a lot of fun, and we can come back and keep going for hours.
I'm going to have you back. I'm going to take you up on that. Thanks again, John.
All righty.
Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, John Cochran, check out his popular blog, The Grumpy Economist, read his books, and watch his interviews. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube as well as on Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.